This is Louisiana Considered. I'm Ryan Vasquez. Just ahead, the Gulf States Newsroom talked to farmers and fishermen about how they're dealing with the worst crawfish season they've ever seen. That's coming up, but first, we continue our special series from Sea Change. Today we bring you the first part of episode 2 of All Gassed Up. Why is the U.S. exporting liquefied natural gas to Europe? We head to Germany to find out, and what that means for the future of our climate.
Now you see the dachshunds, not gooses, they are smaller.
Carlisle and I are sitting in a car, looking out at a muddy beach. We're with Steffi Eilers. That's her quacking.
I'm 50 years old, mother of two.
Steffi's tall, with short blonde hair. She's been showing us around a small port city in northern Germany. It's called Wilhelmshaven. Steffi lives here. She knows everything about this place.
The Baden Sea at the moment is low tide, so we can see the migratory birds and the seagulls eating at the shells that are here in the mud in the front. And at the moment, the sun is rising.
Between the gulls and the sound of the ocean, it almost feels like we're back in coastal Louisiana. Wilhelmshaven also has a mix of wild, protected nature preserves, smack up next to big industry. Driving with Steffi, we see the familiar sight of oil refineries. Although here, they're backdropped by wind turbines.
And now, just in front of us, another familiar sight.
We're just sitting in front of the LNG terminal in the port of Hooksiel.
We're looking at a huge LNG ship. Only it's not just a ship. It's been converted. It's now a liquefied natural gas import terminal, one that floats. And another ship, equally large, is docked at the terminal.
It looks like there's actually an LNG tanker here.
Yes, it came yesterday, and it came direct from Savannah.
Savannah, Georgia. We watch as the tanker unloads American gas.
If Louisiana was ground zero for the American export boom, this is ground zero for the German import boom.
After the ship unloads here, the super-cooled LNG is reheated at this giant floating import terminal. Then the gas is sent down pipelines into Germany and the rest of Europe.
The German parliament leased this floating facility, their first, after the start of the Ukraine war, and the scramble began to get off Russian gas. Because they float, these import ships tend to be considered temporary, able to migrate from port to port as needed. But Steffi wonders if they're stuck with it for good.
Some of the things that I've read is that this terminal is supposed to be, this floating terminal is supposed to be temporary. Do you think that that's true?
No.
Why is that?
We are addicted to gas.
As we sit there with Steffi on the edge of the Baden Sea, we wonder how much American LNG is coming here from back home, from the Gulf Coast.
Steffi didn't know the answers. But she knew a guy who did.
In Hamburg sagt man tschüss.
Jochen Martin was a sailor for 30 years and then a ship captain.
My father was seaman. My grandfather was seaman. Three uncles from me were seaman.
So Jochen knows how to track a ship. He checks the logs daily, and he's been tracking all the LNG ships arriving here.
Sit down here.
We gather around his computer. He pulls up a world map with thousands of tiny arrows in a rainbow of colors.
That's a German bottle. That's all the ships, the green and red.
He starts going down his list of how many LNG ships have come in so far and from what export terminal.
That's the first one that came?
That was the first one, yeah. From Sabine Pass.
Sabine Pass. It's an LNG plant in Cameron Parish, Louisiana. It's currently the largest export terminal in the world. Jochen keeps going down the list.
Freeport.
Texas.
Cameron.
Louisiana.
11. Lake Charles.
Louisiana.
14.
So far, over 40 ships have arrived here from the U.S., nearly all of them from the Gulf Coast. Until the Ukraine war, very little U.S. LNG went to Europe. Now, the only country sending Europe more gas than us is Norway.
Last year, more than 80% of Germany's LNG came from the U.S., enough gas to power almost a fifth of German homes for a year. And even more U.S. LNG arrives in Germany after first making a pit stop in other European countries.
President Biden says this is just the beginning. The U.S. plans to ramp up LNG exports to Europe each year through the end of the decade. But just because President Biden promised Germany to send all this LNG after the start of the Ukraine war, that didn't mean it was so easy for Germany to accept it. Remember, Germany's system relied on Russian gas from pipelines. U.S. LNG comes in on ships. That meant they had to build a whole new system of importing gas. And they had to build it super fast. And it was one guy's job to make it happen. The architect of Germany's energy overhaul.
So, hi, my name is Bengt Becht.
Bengt Becht. What a fun name. Bengt is the deputy speaker for energy and climate of the Social Democrat Party, one of the three parties currently leading Germany's government.
I have two main responsibilities. On the one hand, wind power. As you can see, my room is filled with wind turbines, wind turbine models.
So many models of wind turbines on his desk, hanging on the walls.
Over a quarter of Germany runs on wind power. The country has the most wind turbines in Europe and is actually a global pioneer in green energy. But Bengt says that's despite the super slow process of getting projects approved.
So every windmill in Germany, every windmill, we have 30,000, had a lawsuit on it. Every single one.
When I came to Germany, I knew the stereotype of German efficiency. Punctual people, trains arriving exactly on time.
But Bengt disagrees with this stereotype. Instead of efficiency, Bengt says Germany specializes in bureaucracy.
We are just, we're saying we are managing us to death because we have a gridlock situation in so many cases. If you have to.
Bengt says this bottleneck happens with every new development. And when the gas from Russia stopped, Bengt knew this was no time for gridlock. Fixing this energy crisis was all on his shoulders, because Bengt is in charge of wind power on the one hand.
And on the other hand, the natural gas infrastructure.
So despite the fact that Germany has one of the world's most ambitious renewable energy plans, the country is still very reliant on gas. Bengt says they couldn't just get off it immediately. Big industry runs on gas. Half of German homes are heated with gas. Transitioning off would take time.
And I see a lot of people that say, oh, natural gas is not the right energy supplier. But within the next 10 years, we need the natural gas in the amounts we need it right now.
That meant Bengt had a lot to figure out. So he and his team pulled an all-nighter. And the first thing they came up with was a new law.
And we introduced something we call the überragende öffentliche Interesse.
Will you say that one again?
Yeah, that's überragendes öffentliches Interesse. Yeah.
In English, the LNG Acceleration Act. It was a close vote, but the law passed German parliament. Normally, building any kind of energy project like these LNG import terminals would have taken forever. Because like the U.S., Germany strongly believes citizens have the right to disagree with their government. They have the right to fight projects like these. On top of that, Germany has extremely rigorous environmental reviews. But this newly passed law? Well, it pretty much squashes all of that.
To build the infrastructure we need right now on the fast track, that's why we said, okay, we have to take back lots of the individual rights. Let's step them back. We also enabled that the environmental checkup is being quick passed and say we focus now on the common interest.
The common interest? Saving Germans from the Russian gas crisis. So with this
überragende öffentliche Interesse,
Germany approved 5 LNG import terminals and new pipelines in record-breaking time. And more could be on the way. Huge and expensive publicly funded fossil fuel projects, all of which would have been unheard of in Germany before Russia invaded Ukraine.
Germany is a big gas tanker, but we are moving it like a speedboat right now.
A lot has happened super fast, like this controversial law to throw the country's rules out the window. And it's not how things usually work in Germany. But the government said it all had to happen to move off Russian gas and keep the heat on. And it wasn't just Germany's top politicians who supported this rapid build-out of LNG terminals.
Everybody was worried about a real shortage of gas, and most people were supporting those plans.
Malte Creutzfeldt has been an energy journalist in Germany for 20 years. Malte looks like he's about 7 feet tall. And when we meet on the streets of Berlin, he rides up on his bike while wearing a blazer, hair a little windblown. Malte says most regular Germans also believed that if the country didn't act quickly, they could run out of energy.
There was a big fear that in winter, industry might have to be shut down or even there wouldn't be enough gas for heating.
The German government launched an online campaign urging people to cut energy use. One ad asked Germans to take colder, shorter showers. And it worked. People started turning down their thermostats.
There were even like some bans. You weren't allowed to keep the doors of shops open during the day in winter, so no heat could escape.
Local governments turned off public fountains. Germany even fired up some old coal plants. But more crucially, industrial plants lowered production.
There was a lot of nail-biting. Then winter came. The only LNG plant up and running was the one in Wilhelmshaven. Energy prices were 10 times higher than usual. And yet,
in the end, there was no shortage at all in that first winter.
Using less energy, burning coal, and new LNG was enough to get Germany through that winter with ease, Malte says. The weather was also warmer than usual, so that helped. Everyone was relieved.
And then, after all this fast-tracking of LNG, Germans were like, wait a minute. If we didn't need a gigantic expansion of LNG during that first winter, do we need it at all? Malte says the government started to question the expansion too. There was even a leaked government document that showed the majority of LNG import terminals planned weren't necessary.
There was this big misconception that that we thought we need them, and we don't. We are safe even without them because we can get enough gas from the neighboring countries. Of course, you can say we don't.
Most of Germany's gas actually came from its European neighbors, the Netherlands and Norway. So Germany barely used its new import terminal that winter.
So after creating a law specifically to fast-track LNG import terminals, German parliament slowed down the plans. Instead of building 12 import terminals, parliament cut that to 5. But the officials didn't gut the plans altogether.
Now, the argument of the government is, yes, if everything goes well, we don't need them, but we need them as an insurance for in case something goes wrong.
Politicians are still afraid that another pipeline could be blown up. They don't want to worry about running out of gas. And they also want to diversify, not make the same mistake of being too dependent on energy from any one country.
The only import terminals operating in Germany now are floating ones, like we saw in Wilhelmshaven. There are still plans to build large permanent onshore import terminals, but there's now more pushback on those plans than ever.
There's this feeling we don't need them. Definitely we don't need more.
From the beginning, there were people like Steffi who thought the LNG terminals were a bad idea. She's the woman who took us to see the country's first import terminal in Wilhelmshaven, the one quacking at ducks. Steffi's the leader of a local environmental group. She's super energetic, always zipping around town from one event to another. And she hosts her own radio show, all about energy.
Wir haben Gäste. Ich bin Stefanie Eilers vom Netzwerk Energiedrehscheibe. Hey, Carlisle and Harley, you're both now on air. Like profis in this business.
Yep, we joined her on air to talk about LNG. The day that we met her by the beach on the Baden Sea, she ended up driving us all over her town, looking at nature preserves disrupted by new pipelines. She says bypassing environmental reviews to fast-track LNG is already creating problems.
The ships are poisoning the water. Every ship is poisoning the water.
The floating plants flush their equipment with chlorine to clean it. And a lot of that chlorine gets dumped into the ocean. Even in small amounts, chlorine can be toxic to marine life.
And the chlorine dumping is just one example of environmental consequences. In another city, a new LNG pipeline endangered acres of wetlands. One German island is even suing the government over potential environmental threats from another LNG terminal. And the concerns go beyond the local impact. Environmentalists fear LNG has an outsized contribution to climate change.
We are doing everything, but not thinking about that, what we are living in nature.
We told you in episode 1 that natural gas has long been touted as a bridge fuel, that it's cleaner than coal. But the claim isn't really true, at least not how it's working these days. A little chemistry lesson here. The core component of gas is methane,
When methane's burned, it does release less carbon dioxide than coal.
But turns out a lot of methane gas isn't being burned before it enters the atmosphere. Deep investigations have found that the natural gas industry is very leaky. Methane escapes during drilling, from pipelines, and even out of facilities, at every step.
Over the years, research has found that if methane leaks, it starts to cause problems. You see, methane is a climate superpolluter. It traps at least 85 times as much heat in the atmosphere as carbon dioxide. It's like adding lighter fluid to global warming. And the claim that natural gas is clean gets even more problematic with LNG.
Think about it. The gas industry is already dealing with methane leaks when it comes to gas simply piped to its destination. Now, factor in all the additional chances to leak, plus the huge amount of energy needed to supercool the gas, ship it around the world, and reheat it. New research suggests LNG, over its lifetime, could actually be even worse than coal. Steffi says it's bad for Germany's big climate goals and the whole planet. She says just looking at the floating terminal makes her feel sick. She feels like there are other ways for the country to get the energy it needs.
If you know that lots of billions of euros are taken to raise this instead of renewable energy, we could have built solar panels, we could have built windmills, we could have done all that instead of this, and it could have worked.
The researchers we talked to say it would have been impossible for Germany to build out enough renewables to replace Russian gas in time for winter. But Steffi has a point. Several reports have found Germany didn't need to build new gas import terminals to avoid catastrophe, even without the warm winter. So directing that money toward renewables might have been smarter. But Steffi's biggest worry? That her own country's gas addiction, as she calls it, has ripple effects beyond Germany's borders.
Up next, we find out who's really footing the bill for the expansion of LNG plants back in the U.S.
Sea Change is made possible with support from the Gulf Research Program of the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine. This special series is part of the Pulitzer Center's nationwide Connected Coastlines reporting initiative. From WRKF in Baton Rouge and WWNO in New Orleans, you're listening to Louisiana Considered. I'm Ryan Vasquez. This crawfish season has been a rough one. Farmers and fishermen are catching a tiny percentage of what they normally would, while consumers are paying high prices. WWNO's Eva Tesfaye and the Gulf States Newsroom's Maya Miller talked to crawfish farmers and fishermen about how they're navigating one of the worst seasons they've ever seen.
So Maya, someone told me that there's an app that you can use to look at crawfish prices.
Oh, cool. What's it called?
The Crawfish App.
Oh, that's obvious. Let me look it up.
Yeah, let me know what you see. When I looked at it, it said, like, something crazy, like $9, but that was a few weeks ago.
Yeah, right now I'm seeing crawfish at $7.99, $8.49, even some as high as $9.99 a pound, which is kind of wild because I'm used to buying crawfish for, like, $3 a pound.
Yeah, so those prices are high because of last year's drought. It caused many problems for the people who catch those crawfish for a living. People like Adler Stelly. I went out to his farm in Abbeville, Louisiana, just outside of Lafayette. And Maya, have you ever seen a crawfish farm?
No, I'm not a big fan of the outdoors.
Well, most of them are also rice farms. So picture a wide open flooded field. We head out on a small motorboat to catch the crawfish. He takes out the traps, dumps some crawfish in the boat, tosses a pogie in for bait, and throws it back in the water. He gets a good amount of decent-sized crawfish. It's a bit more than what he's been catching so far, but it won't be enough to save him this season.
There's no way of making back the money that of the inputs that we have out there, but there are crawfish starting to come in areas. We do need the consumers to get out there and start eating a few.
Stilley has been crawfish farming his entire life, and he says this is the worst season he's ever seen. His only silver lining is this happened before he passes the farm down to his daughter.
As hard as it is to take in this type of hit, I'm glad that it's happening to me after I've been in business for a few years and not happening to her on her first year trying to really get in business on her own.
He says inflation was already hitting the farm with the price of labor and bait increasing. Last year's drought made input costs even higher because he had to flood his fields much more than he normally would.
The drought and the extreme heat is also what killed the crawfish. It made the ground so dry that they couldn't breathe, says Mark Shirley, an extension agent with the LSU Ag Center.
There was no moisture to keep the gills working, and they just died. So probably 90% or more of the crawfish died in their burrows during the summertime.
Farmers will also have to pay to replace the crawfish needed for breeding for next year.
Yeah, and that costs a lot of money. Mike Strain is the commissioner at Louisiana's Department of Agriculture and Forestries. He says this drought is costing the industry something like $140 million this year.
Some of the farmers quit fishing completely because there are no crawfish.
Strain, as well as some Louisiana lawmakers, reached out to the U.S. Department of Agriculture for help. They want to activate the Emergency Livestock Assistance Program, which would send payments to farmers. Strain says it would provide much-needed relief to farmers who are in debt.
I'm hearing from the farmers that many of them cannot get another crop loan because they were not able to pay off last year's crop loan, and they desperately need those dollars.
Louisiana's Governor Jeff Landry even announced a disaster declaration to speed up the process.
But there are some people who are going to be left out.
Yeah, it's the wild crawfish fishermen, the people who aren't farming them, like Jody Mesh.
We don't ever get any help from the government.
Mesh is a third-generation Cajun living near the Atchafalaya Basin in South Louisiana. He's been trapping wild crawfish for 30 years and is not eligible for that federal relief.
He says basin water levels have been declining for the past few decades. That means less habitat for the crawfish, and he's had to figure out each slow season on his own.
When COVID hit, you know, we suffered the loss in the market shutting down the same way the crawfish farmers did, and our congressional delegation got millions of dollars of help for the farmers, and the basin fishermen got no help at all.
During a good season, Mesh would collect about 1,000 pounds of crawfish every day. Now he's barely breaking 100. He can sell it at around $8 a pound, which means he could make about $800 for a day's work. But with fuel for his boat and bait for his traps, he's thousands in the hole.
But he says crawfish fishing is what he was raised to do. He wants to continue the legacy of his father and grandfather.
It's just that drive to not be a failure and to be able to continue to do it like they were able to do it.
Until the crawfish recover, he says he'll continue to head out onto the water well before dawn to see what his traps have for him.
For the Gulf States Newsroom, I'm Eva Tesvai.
And I'm Maya Miller.
The Gulf States Newsroom is a partnership among public radio stations in Mississippi, Alabama, and Louisiana. Support WWNO and WRKF today. WWNO just finished their fund drive, but you can still make a donation at WWNO.org. WRKF is currently in their Spring Member Fest. Make a contribution to support this show and other great programs at WRKF.org. And that's Louisiana Considered for today. Thank you to Sea Change hosts Hallie Parker and Carlisle Calhoun for their reporting, and to WWNO's Eva Tesvai and the Gulf States Newsroom's Maya Miller for their story. Our managing producer is Alana Shriver. Our contributing producers are Matt Bloom and Adam Boss. We receive production and technical support from Garrett Pittman and our assistant producer, Aubrey Purcell. You can listen to Louisiana Considered on this station weekdays at 12 noon and 7 p.m. It's available on Spotify, Google Play, and wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening. Again, I'm Ryan Vasquez.
Major support for Louisiana Considered provided by Rouse's Markets, a Louisiana shopping experience, with additional support from the Greater New Orleans Foundation.